Welcome back to the second panel of the A New School Symposium. And I would just like to say in one sentence, because Katrin Peters, the moderator, will say or introduce into the panel shortly, I would like to say why we have had this kind of title, Learning Spaces. For sure, a learning space is, on the one hand, kind of a spatial expression like an architecture, and we will definitely look today also in campus architecture. But with learning spaces, we also meant other learning spaces, which could be actually an exhibition, like our exhibition. I had the chance to revisit Harald Seemann's 1976 exhibition at the Monte Verita, a few weeks ago. And then I understood that this exhibition is the product of why I'm staying here, because I learned so much in this exhibition about different utopias of modernism that this made me interested as a young student already to actually be engaged with these questions. And I think that actually also will be a discussion of this panel. I mean, what kind of learning spaces and how in these learning spaces the way we learn is expressed and performed. I would like to introduce Katrin Peters. She is a professor for the history and theory of visual culture at the University of the Arts in Berlin and co-speaker of the graduate program, The Wissen of, the Wissen, the Knowledge of the Arts. It's in German here, I have to translate it. She researches on the genealogies of design or relation to gender and media, and is also editor of the magazine for media scientists.
Thank you, Marion, for the introduction. And I must say, I'm really pleased to be part of the project, which I have a very, very good impression of. I love the exhibition, and I really enjoyed the first panel this morning. My honor to moderate this panel on new learning spaces, and we have wonderful guests from Brazil, Nigeria, and from Berlin on this panel. They're already sitting here, and so I will just very briefly introduce them and then give a longer introduction to person and talk before the talks. Anna Birrenbach came from Bahia University from Brazil, and she's an expert on Lina Bobardi's work, which is also exhibited in the exhibition hall. Next to her, it's Bayo Amole from Nigeria, who is professor at the Obafemi Awolowo University in Ife Ile, Nigeria, a campus that is very important for the exhibition in the whole, I think. It's an example for the transformations of the Bauhaus legacy. And in the main hall of the exhibition, there's a film screened on display by Svi Efrat on the campus in Ife, Nigeria. Bayo Amole is working there, and so he is really an expert on the architecture and also the experience of the architecture. Then we have Eduard Kögel, an expert in Chinese and German transcultural relations in architecture and planning. And next to him, it's Bofu Obodaga, accompanying Demas Nwoko. Demas Nwoko is a very famous Nigerian artist and architect who came here to introduce us into his work, which is really important for the Nigerian history and for the new way of learning spaces. Bofu Obodaga is his daughter, also an architect, and she will introduce his work. Yeah, please welcome our guests. Yeah, all talks will focus in one way or another on architecture and design for educational and learning purposes. The panel thus will discuss the relation of architecture and a curriculum. And the abstract of the panel asks the question in how far perhaps the new spatial order of learning spaces reflects new ideas of learning and of unlearning as well. I think it's a very important and interesting question, and perhaps we can sharpen it even a bit and ask if the buildings, the physical spaces, perhaps even stimulate and enable new ways of learning, or are they somehow active in learning processes? What is the impact of a building and how we learn, on how we learn and what we learn, and also very important, of what we perhaps unlearn and have to unlearn. Simone Hein in the panel this morning, she said that the Kunsthochschule Weißensee, perhaps the building of the Kunsthochschule Weißensee is not that important. So perhaps you have a different opinion on this, Simone Hein, but we think about the impact of a building, of the physical space, and I think that's also a Bauhaus legacy to think about how we study, how we learn, what we know in special buildings. The term unlearning puts into question shared truth and established knowledge and also convention of what is knowledgeable in order to open up to different perspectives. Do we need, is a question then, an alternative to the classroom to do that, to open up to new perspectives? A second aspect of the panel is a question of hybridity. I think all of the talks will address the question of hybrid forms and the relation between modernist and local forms. And I think it is evident that the international style in architecture is a Western style that has been internationalized. But if we have a closer look, and I think Pater Mitter showed that very convincingly this morning, if we have a closer look to the history of modernity from the post-colonial perspective, we notice that modernism, that's the so-called international style, was always already a hybrid form, an entanglement in transcultural relations, or as Pater Mitter put it, multiple modernity or cosmopolitanism. I think these two perspectives could lead us perhaps to the different examples and connect them amongst each other. And I would just move on to introduce Eduard Kögel, who is our first speaker. Eduard Kögel has published really a lot, numerous articles on the relation between Europe and China, on Chinese architecture, and he is himself, he studied architecture as well as urban and landscape planning with, what he told me yesterday, Lucius Burkhardt in Kassel. Lucius Burkhardt is the founder of the so-called strollology, the science of strolling, I had the idea that this kind of the science of strolling is perhaps connected to the ethnographic term as well, to leave the classroom, to go outside, as we have heard this morning. Eduard Kögel taught at the Technical University in Darmstadt, Germany, in the Department of Non-European Architecture, and received his PhD from Bauhaus University in Weimar with the work on German architects in Chinese exile. He also maintains an internet platform on Chinese architects and is research advisor and program curator of AEDES Network Campus. I want to mention two of these numerous articles, books and catalogs. The first is, it's one of the recent publications. It's the book Grand Documentation. It's a work on Ernst Börschmann and Chinese religious architecture in the beginning of the 20th century, and it came out of a research project at the Technical University in Berlin. And 2016, he published a catalog with AEDES Gallery on Chinese architects and Chinese museums. The most recent publication, I guess, is an article he contributed to the Bauhaus Imaginista catalog, a really weightly catalog in many respects. Article, he focuses on Gropius' encounters with Chinese architect Pei, a topic he is, I think, broaden now for the talk we are going to listen, and I want to mention that Eduard Kögel was also part of the curatorial, curatorial advisor team in the section Moving Away of the exhibition. Eduard Kübel, please.
Thank you very much for this kind introduction. So if you look at this image, you can see that it is not a real authentic tiger. It's something that is copied or overlaying something else. If you look at this brother Sharp, we see a very authentic figure. He appeared in the city of Ningbo in 2010. Someone took his smartphone and he went viral with this image, and within a few weeks, he became a superstar, simply because he's so authentic. And, you know, they started to do a fashion line according to his way of dressing, and this shows that there is a big need of authentic solutions. It doesn't matter where we look at. So if it comes to architecture in China, we very often come across such prestige buildings, and we blame the Chinese for copying some European stuff. But in reality, this was done by Dutch colleagues. Dutch architects designed this, New Amsterdam. Nobody wanted to buy it, so it was torn down after 10 years. It was all time empty. So this was a very original solution. Someone saw that this church of Le Corbusier looks very nice and could be used as a bar. And so they built it in a second-tier city in China, but the French government didn't like it at all. So they intervened and it has to be turned down. If we look at architecture from a historical perspective in China, we will see that there was never an architecture up until 1920s. It was a craft, and this craft was actually something that you could order in with the craftsmen, and they would prefabricate a whole building in the workshop and bring it on site and assemble it on site. So it was done very quickly, and it could be calculated in the workshop, and no architect was needed. And this has a reason behind it, and this is why I want to look a little bit deeper into some very basic aspects of time, space, and environment in China before I show you two examples how China was interpreted by Gropius and Pei and Charoon and Lee. So, time. We understand here in the West time as a very linear development which comes from history and develops into the future in a very mechanical way. But in China, people have a different approach to time. It is about duration and moment. So every moment you can change direction. And in the duration you have a relationship with someone, this manifests your position within a relationship. For instance, just one small aspect. Architects, when they came a few years ago to China, they always wanted to have a contract, and the Chinese didn't understand why. They gave them a contract, but they didn't. The Westerners didn't understand that this contract would be the basis for further negotiations. And this means, you know, you can sign all contracts, but it depends on the moment you might change direction. And so you have to be prepared for that. Same actually happened with space. I mean, we are so egocentric here in the West and don't understand people who are geocentric. And I will show you an example. You know, if we ask this gentleman here to guide us the way down to this blue spot, he will say, go straight ahead, turn right and left again, and you will be at your point. If we ask this gentleman to go the same way, he would say, go south and then turn west and south again, which means he is centered within his environment and is part of this environment, embedded in invisible networks. Therefore, he does not need a kind of an architecture which expresses something to the outside, which is different here, because we are so egocentric here, we are outside of the environment and we represent in public space, and therefore we need buildings which are a symbol of our representation. And this is a very, very big difference, and it's hardly understood even by the Chinese, because it is overlaid today by many influences from Western and industrialized society. If we come to the environment, it's a little bit the same. I mean, there are dramatic environments, but in artistic representations, we see only a very small portion of it, and then the rest of the image is open space where we can have an imagination of the further landscape. And this is also processed through literature and then used for composition in gardens. And this is also what IMPA did, or what we see here in the miniaturization. You can take it into your living room and having a memory of a real landscape which is associated to literature and other kinds of arts. IMPA did such a composition in a museum he did in Suzhou a few years ago. But if we come to Gropius and Pei back in 1946, Gropius got a commission to design this university in Shanghai. It was on a former airfield. I mean, there was nothing on the side. So he asked I.M. Pei to join this this group, and Pei designed, first of all, a waterscape, because in the Chinese context, you are part of the environment, and therefore you can change the natural environment in the way you want it to have it. So that means there is no given landscape which you have to protect, because you are part of it. Therefore, you can change it in the way it fits your own ideas. I mean, in this case, I.M. Pei and Gropius and the whole troop, they developed this university, and Pei made a sketch to show the buildings and how they are embedded. And we see this is a kind of a courtyard composition, and if we look at the architecture, we see that I.M. Pei was much more impressed by Mies van der Rohe, but also by traditional architecture. So he combined the traditional idea of prefabricated units in order to bring them together in a way Mies proposed in his architecture. So, I mean, this was a kind of a hybrid space which was then developed for Shanghai. It was not built. But later example, Pei moved the whole program to Taiwan, where he was able to build a university. We see here Hans Scharoun and Chen Quinli. During the 1940s, they were not allowed to build here in Berlin. They were not in emigration. And so they founded a Chinese-German Werkbund, which they called CHIWEP. And there they discussed issues about feng shui, and they tried to understand what feng shui is. They couldn't understand because there was not enough literature around, and Chen Quinli had left China when he was 15 years old. So it was an interpretation, and they came up that the landscape is very important. And if we look at the drawings of Hans Scharoun in that period, we see that landscape became a very, very critical issue in his drawings and how he tried to define a new architecture. For Chen Quinli, I asked him in an interview what inspired him to study feng shui. Then he said, well, I don't know exactly, but I'm a Taoist and I love jazz. And this is what inspired me for my architecture. And so he went, when he got a commission, he went on site and then did some Tai Chi and things to experience space. And then, of course, he changed the landscape completely before he designed the building. And when they got a commission for a school in Darmstadt, Hans Scharoun got the commission, but Chen Quinli was the architect within the team, they analyzed the whole city, and then from this bigger environment, they came up with this new concept of a school, which was related to the environment, to the bigger environment, in a way that you would look at from a Chinese perspective. In both cases, we see that the design is informed by traditional ideas, but it was in both cases an interpretation in a very creative way that allowed them to develop ideas which they could implement in later projects, and which shows that modernity is not something which is only developed in the West, but it was always informed by many sources of many backgrounds, and in this case, it was informed by Chinese thoughts and topics. Thank you.
perfectly in time, Eduard. We have the opportunity for some brief questions related to the talk directly. Are there any questions in the audience? Not yet. Okay, then it's you, Mario, but I will join you.
By Bayo Amole. I already briefly introduced him. He is a professor of architecture at Obafemi Awolowo University in Ile Ife in southeast Nigeria. The university in Ile Ife was built by Southwest of Nigeria. I'm really sorry. The university in Ile Ife was built by architect Ariel Sharon, and it's one of very big protagonists of the Bauhaus Imaginista exhibition. The film by Zvi Efrat, I've already mentioned, is on display in the exhibition, and Bayo Amole is also starring in this film, and he's very interesting interviewee. And he, at one point he says, and I think that's related to what Eduard Kugel just said, that you become part of the university of the campus. The building is somehow becoming part of you, and you become part of the building. And that is perhaps related to what you said, that the Chinese architects are part of the landscape, or the landscape is part of the building. So there is a relation between humans and non-humans, if you want to say it like this, and there's a relation between the buildings and the landscapes with the human body. Bayo is an expert in campus architecture in Nigeria and is very requested participant in architectural councils and associations all around Nigeria. And he's currently editor of a monograph series called Architectural Files. Bayo will us now tell more about the Obafemi Awolowo University that was designed and realized in the 60s and 70s by Ari Sharon, who studied at the Bauhaus with Hannes Meyer. Please.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I just want to state this. I take it for granted that the evidence for the Bauhaus is embedded in Ariel Sharon and the work he did at Ife, because I'm not going to put emphasis on all that. But what I want to do is to show that Sharon left a legacy in Ife. That is, he left us in Ife some kind of inheritance, and that has guided the university beyond just the work that Sharon did. It's important to me because every master plan has some kind of guidelines on what you ought to do beyond just the simple buildings designed by the architect. But here, he's left us a legacy that is possible to interpret continuously. And this is the the central thing about Sharon, and that beyond this, the legacy he has left us, apart from the fact that it's possible to gain influence from the ideas that he left, it is also the case that Sharon has left us a legacy about culture and identity that is normally not thought of in relation to modernism. By doing this, he expands the scope of modernism in a very, very special way, because he spent 20 years doing many of these things in Ife, and it is clear that he understood the Yoruba context. in which he was working. And this architectural character and identity that Aaron Sharon has left us has been done by a process that any architect that wants to work in an environment like that must call on. Call on, because architecture helps us to realize ideas. It's not just the image that it produces, but that it helps us to realize ideas. Then the whole project itself challenges any modernist scholar in many ways, because apart from dealing with culture and identity inside the Yoruba enclave itself, he was dealing with the idea of architecture and the fact that architecture has a memory of its past. That would sound like nothing, but to the modernist, history was not something to be called upon. But Sharon has a way of subverting this idea by presenting it, not just in its raw form, but as a symbolic thing, and to which we must cast our minds. We can't help it but remember it. So it does a double thing in Ife, of dealing with the culture and also the culture of architecture itself in a broader sense. Every time we write history, we are thinking of thematic issues that are also global. And in that sense, he links us to the global and the local. So when we talk about a hybrid situation, it's not just the image, but those ideas that come together and create something that is wonderful. I just want to present an overview of the master plan. At first, I want to present it because it does show us that it was a modernist project. And indeed, it's a modernist city. Someone has described it as the Cité Université, calling on the French term, saying it's a university city. And he does so by showing us in the tradition of Siam, the fact that you have a functional city with a central business district and all the other facilities around it. And by doing this, he spent time principally on the core area of the university. This is where most of the building he designed, this is where they are. There are one or two other buildings, so three other buildings outside the core area, like the Vice-Chancellor's Lodge, the students' residences, two of them. But most of this work has been in the core area. And then, of course, within it, as we look at it, we'll see that he has merged together. It's the coming together in marriage of landscape, art objects, and architecture. And this continuous use of craft as a basis for architecture is difficult initially when you look at it, but you see it as you get along, to work with the hands and to continue to ask that the human engagement with objects is realized in every situation, from the big building to a small drain that is produced there, is actually part of what he has gained from the Bauhaus, because he was working with artists, planners, landscape architects, and even musicians. It's so for him, you realize in the architecture of the campus all of these things. Now I show the central area there, which shows the architecture of the core area. Most of the buildings are, of course, in the modernist tradition and all that. But one would like to point to a particular thing, which is the historicity of that core area, because it produces for us at the center a large space that is essentially an open space that brings together students and staff and all of that. But as I said, it's a historical thing, because for him, this space is one that was that has come from a medieval tradition, that one that opened up the monasteries and turned them into what Oxford and Cambridge have termed the courts within the university that were sacred places. But now Sharon opens them up, and in a tradition of Jefferson's academical village in Virginia, in the US, he's opened up, and now it's not the church that is at the head of it, but the library. He, in a sense, he co-opts the historical to create that physical form that we have there. And every time you cross that place, you are reminded that you are in a sacred place and it's the university. For us, it's really a pleasant place to be in. Then in the modernist sense, of course, he also uses the gridiron plan. He plans the circulation is largely by the gridiron plan. But the wonderful thing is that ordinarily, I would say to my student, if you came up with a gridiron plan in that kind of environment, I would say to you that this is very rigid. Nobody does, especially when it's not about the circulation of cars. But here, Sharon does it. And I think I have come to accept it because of the experience of living in it. He opens up the entire grid in different and specific areas so that, you know, the margin of the external space with the internal space does not, you are not bored by the fact that you are turning left or right or any, so no, no, no. The entire space is marked and it will seem appropriate for you to walk through the whole space, even from walking on what appears like the large circulation area. This, I think, is a quality of that area that is well worthwhile. Then we look at architecture and identity. Now, as I said, Sharon worked with the Yoruba culture, and he has a good understanding of the Yoruba people. The first thing is that he enlists Yoruba art and architecture. It's not quite clear to many people that ornamentation, which would have seemed anathema to the modernist tradition, he enlists it in a way that is more Yoruba than anywhere else. The Yoruba is of course the ethnic group in the Southwest, predominantly Yoruba in the Southwest. But he has all these ornamentations on buildings and all that, something that would normally not come from the colonial modernists. But here he uses ornamentation the same way that the Yoruba would use it in different buildings. And it's a deep understanding of Yoruba art and culture, because you'll find that as a legacy, many other buildings on campus took on this. In fact, we had an artist who had produced many of the artworks on the buildings, but this came from Ariel Sharon himself when he did the entire place. And so, but how did he do it? I think it's nice, it's very wise to speak about this. But first, I showed this obelisk as an example of the kind of artwork that Sharon did. But the obelisk itself looks very small, but it is a replica of one piece, one historical piece that is at the center of town in Ilefe itself. Now, it's a mythical one that says that one of the children of the founding fathers of Ilefe itself had this big, what do they call it? Walking stick. And the walking stick is a piece of stone that stands as an obelisk somewhere. But Sharon has used it as a piece of artwork. He not only puts it in front of the library, at the beginning of the ramp that leads to the library, almost like in a Corbusian style, the ramp goes up to the library. But because the scale was not appropriate, he wraps it up in a bigger form and enlarges the scale. And I had often told myself, if you removed what he did in wrapping it up, it would look inconsequential. But he was very, very careful, even about using all these pieces of artwork all around the campus. Now, how does he do it that he can make so many things in looking at the culture and at the same time using enlisting architecture to represent culture and identity? I've shown here a parquet. This is Sharon's parquet for most of the buildings. And this parquet has formed the basis for many buildings on campus. He creates a courtyard, and it is many times it's covered, but it is a pleasant courtyard. In the middle of the building, and the ground floor is on Pilates. The building itself is on Pilates. So the ground floor doesn't have doors, and you can come into the building from almost anywhere. While at the same time, as you come into the building, you also come into this central core area. It is quintessential Yoruba way of thinking. The outside must be brought into the building. Not only must it be brought into the building, it must also you must leave it. It's a place to live. It's not just that you have brought it as something that is just ephemeral, but that in his hands, you have to leave it. You have to live within the courtyard, which is typically Yoruba, not to live inside those rooms, but to live in the courtyard. And it's something that you cannot help but think of as you come into those buildings. Then Sharon doesn't stop at his parquet. Like, he also does the modernist twist. He does something to the modernist box by not relying on the skin, but he then continuously uses a parquet that is more like using the building itself and the structure as the basis for climatic changes, of climatic protection of the building. He doesn't add all the brise soleil. He that's not the point, but the building itself is the protection for climatic problems. And it then produces a building buildings that are indeed very special. It's an inverted pyramid, but he does not bore you with this inverted pyramid by repeating it in many places, but that it's an idea, and he uses it in different ways, combining it with the fact that you must live outside. You must bring the outside into the building itself. Then, of course, I'm showing some of the things that were done much later. Here is a door for a building. It's by an artist, a very popular Yoruba artist, somebody called Agbofolarin. He died a few years ago, but he was a professor of art on campus, and he produced all of these. And even in this next building that I'm showing, it's the Students Union building. We also have pieces of art all over the building. Now, you have influences of those other buildings, and I wish to show the examples.
10 minutes are up already.
I wish to show the examples so that we'll see how many others have enlisted Sharon's ideas to produce a unified campus, because it's important. I think the symbolism has been extended to all of this by taking on Sharon's ideas, but not making them in this boring manner. Now, this is the pharmacy building that was built in the 70s, and it uses the same idea of the central core that Sharon uses. And here we see it, it's open, and open in such a way that central area becomes like the court to the place. And in its traditional form, the building was on pilotis. And so those ideas continue to be seen across the buildings, the open access, and all of that. Then, of course, the next building is the African Studies building. This is one of the most interesting buildings on campus. Why? Because it's one of the most intensely used buildings. Dramatic arts, fine art, music. Sometimes it's a life that is, you know, somebody had said to me that you cannot be sad if you enter that building. Somebody playing music, another, a group of people having rehearsals for drama and all that. It's also the case that such open spaces are important to the Yoruba people. Now, in this place, I show the eastern entrance. That entrance has been closed off entirely. Why? Because the formality of an entrance for these Yoruba folks is not the most important thing. And it has to be a more open thing. And now we see the side. On the southern end, it's opened. And the architects, British architects, decided that it was best that they would open it up. And you still now have an open building where indeed it's represented by courts. The other example is this, the central cafeteria, because it used to be a place for the cafeteria for the students, and it follows the idea of a party that is useful. Sharon's idea of setting up a geometrical party and allowing a courtyard in the middle was of essence. Finally, Sharon defines the modernist box. He uses this modernist box, merging the climatic response and the cultural identity. The merging of the craft of architecture, art, and landscape in one design. All present a context for the extraction of endless ideas, and this is what has influenced other architects working on the Ife project. That's Sharon's legacy in Ife. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mario Amole. That was a really interesting overview of the building and a lot of important thoughts. Do we have a pressing question concerning the topic? So we collect the questions and bring them up in the final discussion. Thank you. Okay, I think. Yeah. Bufo Obodaga is going to introduce the work of Demas Nwoko. Obofo is architect herself and is developing an own architectural practice, but has said that her father was also her teacher. So you're very influenced and very connected to his work. Demas Nwoko is a famous artist, designer, and architect and stage designer as well. He was a student at Zaria Art School in Ibadan and one of the major protagonists of Zaria Art Society, an important art movement founded in the late 60s, also referred to as Zaria Rebels, questioning the ways art was taught and produced. The Natural Synthesis Manifesto, the group has released, and this manifesto advocates the relation between pre-colonial Nigerian art and an eclectic modernism. With Uko Okeke and Uli Bayer, he was member of the Mbari Club in Ibadan. We had taught at the university throughout the 60s and 70s. In the 70s, Demas Nwoko co-published a critical African arts magazine called New Culture. Demas Nwoko built, amongst other, the Dominican Church in Ibadan and the Ibadan Cultural Center, which is, I guess, but I'm not sure, one of the main topics of the talk. Yeah. Yeah, we are welcome. Welcome you again and happy, really happy and proud you are here.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's always an honor to stand here with my father, Demas Nwoko, who I identify with very strongly. I've always worked with him. Ever before I entered into university, I started practicing architecture. And I will still work together. I'll just go straight because of the time. We're going to be talking about the New Culture School for Arts and Design. It includes the physical development of a space which can be used by all creative people to advance their professional proficiency in arts, theater, music, film, photography, design, writing, and much more. Every one of these areas are actually areas where Demas himself is an expert in. This is his paper, so when I say I actually mean him. Okay. I started to construct the New Culture Studios in 1969 in a location on a hillside with the building of my personal studio for painting, sculpture, and my residential villa. That's a view overlooking the whole of Ibadan from the studio. Well, a good section of Ibadan from the studio. This was later extended to include an amphitheater carved out of the hillside, modeled after the ancient Epidaurus amphitheater in Greece, as a one-to-one scale model to be used for the design and construction later of a model African theater in Benin City, Nigeria. At this time, I was a foundation faculty member of a new school of drama in the University of Ibadan, Nigeria, where I taught stage design and decor, dance and African aesthetics. For want of what to do with a live space, live scale amphitheater, which I had scooped out of the hillside of my studio, I started to take my dance classes in the dusty amphitheater. Now, talking about moving the class from the inside, outside. This initiated the idea of extending my personal studio to include other studio facilities for postgraduate teaching for the graduates of arts and theater. To do this effectively, I started to build up the ad hoc theater space into a fully fledged theater building. At this point, the pioneering arts institution founded in 1960 called the Mbari Artists and Writers Club, was having survival difficulties because the grants that established it had run out. This all-important meeting point for emerging African writers and artists, apart from exhibiting their artworks, had a publishing outfit that published the works of these writers, bringing them for the first time to the attention of the world. They also published an art journal called The Black Orpheus, which disseminated their works. To rescue this institution for artists and writers, I decided to move its entire activities to my studio by the year 1970. This resulted into the establishment of a new publishing house within the New Culture Studios, which started also to publish the New Culture magazine in 1976. Amongst other occasional arts and theater publications. Before the New Culture publications, I had equipped the studio with a film and film laboratory for the practice of cinematography. With these developments in the studio and the African Model Playhouse needing to be completed, I decided to withdraw my services from the University of Ibadan in 1978. This gave me the time to concentrate on the development of the studio as a comprehensive new school for arts and design. The philosophy behind the New Culture Studios. I decided to set up the New Culture Studios out of the conviction that an institution of this nature is needed for the ultimate development of fine, applied, and performing arts in modern Africa's society. As a postgraduate school, it plays a contemporary role to our tertiary institutions, professionals, and practicing finishing programs for the arts. I have benefited from such institutions in France in 1960. The traditional African society utilizes art of all kinds profusely in a very high aesthetic level, making a demarcation between fine and popular arts irrelevant. The institutions of traditional society demanded forms as necessary integral parts of life and living. The architecture applied artistic decors. The quality of a utensil is enhanced by worked patterns. Furniture is exquisite when carved, and religious organizations commission works of art for their shrines. These institutions of society continue to exist in different forms, relatively modified by the influences of foreign cultural values and the amalgamation of tribal cultures. A new cultural synthesis still have to crystallize into a homogeneous cultural form, and it is this new form that I have chosen to call the new culture. A new aesthetic language has to be forged that will produce expressions meaningful to all. This new language, being fashioned out of the rich variety of our traditional past and the realities of the present, the new culture will be acceptable to everyone in the society, irrespective of tribe and social status, because it will speak the true philosophy of African life and aesthetics. The philosophy that would see the African through a technological civilization without the danger of losing his deep consideration of human and nature. The new culture art will utilize the most technological advanced equipment and production techniques to facilitate its production and dissemination. But the new art is not a patchwork of foreign and African aesthetics and cultural values. It is a new African art expressed in music, dance, drama, design, painting, sculpture, films, architecture, town and city planning, and literature, all founded in African aesthetics, philosophy, and so eloquently expressed in our indigenous languages. You really can't separate them. The cooperation between I'm going to leave some of this for him to also talk about himself. So I'll take this bit now. The cooperation between man and machine, referred to as technocraft. Briefly, technology is developed to the extent of human cultural needs at any given time. If technology is allowed to develop beyond their immediate needs, the tenacity is for man to begin to feel redundant, meaning the true value of man is in his ability to control development and technology. I'm very sure Dimas would talk more on that. Difference with our New Culture Studio of Arts and Design is that the training places emphasizes the culture over technology. Culture-driven and not exclusively technological driven. Technology is now mostly IT. We cannot adequately design a building on a computer since people cannot move in. Technology is a manipulation of materials, and that is not the essence of architecture, which is an art. A building is a house. It houses human beings in comfort. And humans are cultural beings. For example, the design of a football stadium has evolved to take into the consideration the cultural changing of people. necessitating the introduction of barriers to prevent pitch evasion. The formation of a designer, therefore, should include the study of history, anthropology, and cultural studies to create a true, comfortable environment for their human benefactors. In the culture option, the human being is at the center of everything. To serve people, you must first understand how they live their lives. In essence, culture is the deliberate creation of man, and its realization is entirely controlled by man himself. This control is jealously guarded. Therefore, any adjustment made are also the decision of man himself. Man should use technology to make the products needed to produce all the physical needs that will ensure his true comfort of living. Thank you. Dimas will come up now, and he will talk on some of these. Okay, Baba, you can go on. No, the microphone is there right beside you.
My leg will be shaky a bit.
No, you don't need it. There's a microphone right there.
Yes, okay. Okay. Is it on?
It's on.
Okay. You know.
Just go ahead. I think that's fine. Do you want to have it in your hand?
No.
I think that's fine.
Oh, yes, if it can work that way. Yes, okay. I would say that I thank the organizers for inviting me to this meet. I think it was really accidental because it started with inviting me to the symposium in Lagos, which was meant for Ife University. I don't know really how they got to pull me into that place. And now, they have pulled me all along, you know, as if by a rope here. Because having sat here now through the first session and now this, I look like a sphinx. Because everybody who have talked are young people, and then they are talking about some other person and their works. But here I am. I'm not going to talk about my work. Maybe in future, I hope some people will talk the way these scholars have talked since morning. The real issue here is about training, about training curriculum, and that's where I started, but permit me when I say we, you know, all the time, because there were others in this movement. And it was interesting to listen to the lecturer from India talking about the creation of the design school, and after the difficulty it faced, and in fact, a crisis of identity, or even being officially recognized as a school of design, not knowing if they would be recognized as a university, as a tertiary institution, or not. That crisis seemed to exist in the middle belt of the world, normally referred to as the southern, you know, because I think the world seemed to be divided into north and south. The north is the developed world, and then the south is the developing world. This southern part were all colonized. you know. So they have the same problem about education and curriculum. Just as she was asking, well, he doesn't know exactly why they came or what they were looking for. In our zone of direct colonialism, we knew what they were looking for. They were looking for materials, they were looking for raw products to fuel their industries run with high technology. Really, these areas seem to be, in their calculation, irrelevant, really, as a culture, as a relevant culture. So the education curriculum in all the colonies seem to have been designed for few of the people to help them man the administration of these colonies. They never designed them to make the citizens of the colonies creative and industrially productive. Because, if they did that, they'd be shooting themselves in the foot because they have to do the whole production and then consume it and then sell their surplus to their colonies. So our schools it was a simple program which taught us what they wanted to teach us. In this manner, as I said, the people themselves were not considered, they were not consulted as to what do you want to learn. No. That in itself left the people of the colonies or the people of the South in a way creatively bereaved, you know. They had their culture of a production. They had their culture of creativity. I wouldn't say that they were not living fine. Everybody in their own zone was living, they had problems and all that. But given time, I think everybody would have solved their own problem, because if you look at problem as a cultural need, you can always solve that problem. Our own view of culture is not a fixed way of life. In fact, the fact that we didn't have a written tradition helped in keeping our culture continuously evolving, very vibrant. It was never at a standstill. So it made us very flexible. And that, I think, the Western world still can't understand. But I see it as a great advantage. We are quick learners, not because we are capitulating to our exploiters and all that. No, but we are so confident that we can adapt. You know, just like the animal they call a chameleon. You know, it changes its color depending on where it finds itself. We know that is us. Then when the colonizers started to create institutions in Nigeria, Yes, it was the missionaries at first, basic learning of English and arithmetic, you know, and then you can serve in the civil service, postal, change buttons to the railway, drive a locomotive and all that. Those were not difficult, you know. It could be done. So our tertiary institutions were created. Naturally, all our teachers came from Europe. And I didn't expect them to teach what they didn't know, meaning to teach our culture to us or our history. It was okay for them to teach what they knew from Europe, though they knew where to stop. They didn't, those decisions were not open to everything that was being learned in Europe. So when we joined the first tertiary institution in Nigeria as a student, in this case, this institution included School of Engineering.
We have to go on.
Yes, please. Architecture and all that. Of course, the University of Ibadan, the University of Ife. It might be interesting for you to know that the students of that first generation rebelled against what we are taught to them. For example, in Ibadan, while they were learning English literature and how to write poems and plays like Shakespeare, Milton, and all that, when it was their own turn to write their own play, they wrote plays that were Nigerian. And their teachers did not understand those plays. I remember they said no, that these were not plays, that these were not poems, that human beings don't speak like that. And I said, but that's our culture, you know. So too, in fine art, when we got there, yes, they were not teaching anything about African art. So, and we have known that African art has been recognized in Europe as a valid art, you know, and that has helped the modern European artists to move away from realism of the Renaissance period. Of course, getting to art in the Bauhaus of Paul Klee and all of them. Yes, but they were not teaching us in a way to now say that if the traditional African art helped European artists to move away onto new frontiers, then why wouldn't us learn about our own traditional African art?
Okay, I think
so. That caused the first revolution, really. And architecture too didn't recognize that Africa had any traditional architecture at all. Yes.
We have to come to an end because we have one more speaker.
Okay, sorry.
Yes.
Okay.
I'm really sorry to interrupt you, but we have to move on, and I thank you a lot for this really very, very important comment.
Yes.
I think we have an applause for
him. Yes. Okay, thank you.
Very important comment. And we address these issues again in the discussion. Yes, in the discussion. Mm-hmm. We have the final discussion all together.
Okay.
Yeah?
Okay.
So, but thank you a lot. That was really enriching for our whole conversation. Anna Carolina Birrenbach is our final speaker on this panel. Where are you? Yeah, you're here. Anna is professor in the Department of Architecture at the University of Bahia, Brazil. She studied architecture, urbanism, and history, and wrote her PhD on Italian-Brazilian architecture and researcher Lina Bobardi. Anna is really an expert on the work of Lina Bobardi. She organized exhibitions on her work. She's has a deep knowledge on Lina Bobardi's archive, and in the Bauhaus Imaginista web journal, she has a very interesting article on Lina Bobardi. I really want warmly to recommend, as Anna proposes there in this article, to put into question the distinction between conception and production, and I think that's a very good proposal for the discussion as well, of the legacy of the Bauhaus. Her talk will focus Bobardi's plan for a school for industrial design in the 50s and 60s, a plan for a museum school that could not be realized due to political reasons. Yes. Thank you. Welcome.
Yeah, give an applause.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity of being here and also sharing this panel with these important guests. Well, my talk today will be about Lina Bobardi's experience at the Museum of Popular Art and School of Industrial Design and Crafts in Bahia, Brazil, exactly in Salvador de Bahia, where I live. In the late 50s, the Italian-Brazilian architect Lina Bobardi executed a series of design objects to be used in her proposal for the Museum of Popular Art and for the School of Industrial Design and Handicrafts to be located in a place called Solar do União, in Salvador, the capital city of the state of Bahia, in the northeast of Brazil. The most important one was an imposing staircase, which used wood as a system of articulated fittings often found on oak carts that have existed in the country since the colonial period. The staircase provides clues to the architect's intention for the museum school and its connection with the forces of Brazilian popular culture. So this is the stair. Among the aspects of the Brazilian popular culture that interested her were the handicraft objects produced by the most impoverished section of the country's population. These objects, like the oak cart, were usually produced using materials, techniques, and procedures known in the territory. Some were made from the discarded leftovers from industry and consumer waste. The architect's attention was drawn by both the precariousness and the potential that these objects display. She stated that such populations sought to meet demands that could not be satisfied from the existing industrial production that wasn't available throughout the country and which, in any case, was inaccessible economically and inadequate from both an utilitarian and an aesthetic point of view. All of these encouraged her to create a documentation center for the Northeast population handicraft. It was her intention to trace and catalog the production of these objects. Bobardi herself made expeditions across the Northeast territory in search of such objects. The architect's next step was to create exhibitions and museums in which knowledge about the existence of such objects and the context they inhabited could be spread. To this end, Bobardi took advantage of an invitation to assume the directorship of the Museum of Modern Art in Bahia. At the same time, she also dedicated herself to the creation of a Museum of Popular Art in the same city. Circumstances led to both the museum, both museums having a common headquarter for a period at a site restored by Bobardi herself, known as the Solar do União. One opportunity to disseminate traditions of popular Northeastern handicraft and their context took place in the Civilização Nordeste exhibition at the Solar do União, which was inaugurated at the end of 1963. This exhibition presented many objects, which were the result of very specific creative capacity found among the Northeast population, aiming to meet their daily needs with the most limited of the means. Bobardi stated that these were important examples for modern industrial design. But the act as proposal, but the act as proposal was more ambitious. She intended to create, in addition to these museums, a school of industrial design and handicraft, rendering her mapping of techniques, materials, and procedures used in Northeastern handicraft an essential undertaking. Her idea was to use this knowledge to conceptualize an authentically Brazilian form of industrial design production, one able to satisfy the real needs of the population. It wasn't her intention to keep intact the system she called pre-craft, but to couple its basis with modern industrial system, making possible the transformation both of forms and materials, while also keeping intact the creative capacity of the population. One of the key issues for Bobardi was to narrow the gap between creation, execution, and use. The architect intended to develop a course of 2 years, including both theoretical and practical knowledge. Conceivers and producers, in her view, had to work together and exchange their respective areas of expertise in order to create objects that would meet the real demands of the Brazilian society. Bobardi wanted to create prototypical objects that could be scaled up into industrial production. The proposed layout of Solar do União physical space indicates the content of the school proposed by the architect. It consists of a series of structures designed at different times, which assume different uses throughout its history. Among these buildings, the mansion stands out. It initially housed a family of a rich landowner on its upper floors, with the lower floor reserved for the slave quarters. On the upper floor, around the aforementioned staircase, she intended to host exhibitions of popular handicraft, while on the lower floor, in the former slave quarters, a popular restaurant was to be built. Oh, that's it. Sorry, I'm kind of late here. That's the mansion. Where am I now? The old church would house an auditorium for lecture as well as a library. In the old pavilion, several experimental workshops. On a big square near the seashore, there would be facilities for events, parties, dances, and concerts. Just outside at the Solar do União, beneath the arch supporting an avenue bordering the building, Bobardi imagined a market for selling objects produced at the school. Bobardi's conception of the museum school made clear that her comprehension of popular culture could not be understood as what she termed folklore, a lifeless representation of popular conditions. Rather, she understood popular culture as a practical, dynamic, and transformative action capable of interfering in a positive and effective way in the life of the population, both those who produced handicraft and those who consumed it. Bobardi's aspiration were quickly ended by the military coup of 1964. The exhibition Civilização Nordeste was perceived as a critic of the miserable conditions in which much of the Brazilian population lived, ended up by being banned by the dictatorship. The conditions for realizing both the envisioned popular art museum and the School of Industrial Design and Crafts were no longer. But Bobardi's experience with hybrid museum schools did not begin with her work at the Solar do União. Here again. In the early 50s, Bobardi had the opportunity to participate in the structuring of the Institute of Contemporary Art in São Paulo, EAC, connected with the Museum of Modern Art, MASP. That's this one. The museum was founded and directed by her husband, Pietro Maria Barri, in 1947. The idea was that the museum should play a didactic role capable of stimulating the public appreciation and understanding of contemporary art. The same sort of mission planned for the Museum of Modern Art of Bahia. With this aim, the EAC was created, in which Bobardis played an important role as coordinator of the industrial design course. I'm lost here. The intention of the course was to train technical professionals who would be able to develop and produce modern objects capable of being reproduced industrially. The EAC had a short duration, lasting only from 1951 to 1953. There are similarities and differences between the experience of the EAC and the School of Industrial Design and Crafts. Both shared the intention of reducing the distance between the development and execution of consumer products, aiming to stimulate a linkage through existing industries in São Paulo and the incipient ones in Bahia. Nevertheless, in both instances, the connections were never consolidated. But there were also differences. During her time at the São Paulo School, Bobardi had not yet realized the potential of Brazilian culture and the possibilities of assimilating its materials, techniques, and procedures in order to create objects of an authentic national design character. In addition, during her Bahia experience, Bobardi had the advantage of her prior experience in São Paulo, where she realized that the social function of the design profession and the potential impact of its products. That enabled her to envision the possibilities of social transformation which might result from articulating the school craftsman industry on a territorial scale, as well as the democratization of access that might result from the products created. Further connections can be drawn between these Brazilian experiments and those occurring at other schools internationally. In the case of the EAC, there is a relationship with the Darcel period of the Bauhaus. Following the Bauhaus pedagogical program, the EAC also aimed to provide a form of training that brought together creation and execution, simulating a mode of teamwork between craft production and the industry. However, according to Leon, there are no references in the EAC's discourse to the democratization and utopian role of industrial design, something that is a component of the Bauhaus education system. With regard to the Bahia School, there are also many connections with the Bauhaus proposal. According to Rossetti, both schools aimed at enhancing relations between the craft and industrial spheres through experimentation with various techniques and materials in order to create design prototypes that could be adapted to industrial production. The relationship between craft and industry promoted by these schools lies not only in the dimension of the products, but also the producers who were trained to be inserted into the field of industrial production. Both objectives aimed to transform social reality. But according to Bobardi, there were also dissonances between the proposals. The Bauhaus was more abstract in how it stated aims could be pursued, while the Bahia School was intended to be more connected to the real circumstances and local demands. Bobardi claimed, I'm quoting, "A school like Bauhaus or metaphysical experimental would be useless in a young country like Brazil with the strongly primitive and earth-bounded factors, very modern factors." Over the time, Bobardi realized that the forces of popular culture she had detected when she first moved to Bahia in the late 50s were being eliminated by the process of industrialization that were carried out in Brazil over the course of the second half of the 20th century. Brazilian industrialization ended up manufacturing products unrelated to popular techniques, materials, and procedures. Superfluous, non-durable products were made, products that were designed to be quickly consumed and disconnected from the real needs of the citizens. It was in this new social reality of consumption which spurred Bobardi's later criticism of Bauhaus, which, according to the Octet, ended by forsaking its initial goals of transforming reality through art, ideals that became, in the end, phantasmatic and utopian. In the Brazil of today, a significant part of the population still exists in miserable conditions, using a variety of improvised survival strategies to get by. Contemporary forms of bricolage include the production of the everyday objects. Thus, Bobardi's clear denunciation of the mistake of adopting Western forms of industrial production to Brazilian circumstances continues to resonate. The forces of popular production that might transform Brazil's reality continue to be suppressed.
Well, just to the photographs were made by these three people. I thank you for your attention.
Yeah, thank you very much, Anna. Perhaps we take the questions concerning directly your talk into the final discussion we now enter. Yeah, thank you all of you for your very, very rich input. And I'm a bit confused, I must admit, where we can start and how we can mingle through these different topics. I just propose to raise the question of hybridity and hybrid forms once again. And I want to connect also to Demas Mboko's commentary that I think we should be aware of asymmetrical hybridization, because the hybrid form term sometimes suggests that there's just some mixtures and some elements from there and there, but that doesn't, isn't the political situation in the colonial context. So perhaps we can go first back to you, Bayo, and the university campus in Ife is, of course, a project from the West with a big plan, and you always have argued that there is something there in transformation took place. So the dominant modernist form was somehow transformed in something else, and so it doesn't seem to turn out to be too colonialist. Perhaps you can.
Yes, I think one of the things that I probably didn't mention is simply that Sharon didn't work in a vacuum. We had had a precedent. That was the University of Ibadan. That was done about, 48 or? That was the colonialist one. Mm-hmm. Colonialist modernism, you would say. Maxwell Fry and Jane Drew working in Ibadan. And just some 80 kilometers from Ife itself. So it was in this platform, in this situation, that he had to work. So he was armed with modernism, but modernism of a different kind that had to move away from the typical Ibadan model. Architects work with precedents, and you would imagine that an Israeli coming to a place like that would look on precedents. But he had to do much more than that, because the political situation, in fact, didn't allow him to just look on such precedents. So you have, in effect, a certain sense of hybridity going on and the idea of modernism. But I always prefer to say it was a continuous reinterpretation, moving away from it, but interpreting modernism itself in a way that was suited more to the historical, the cultural, and one which understood the identity of the people. I think that was the thing, combining all of this with the idea that architecture did far more than just the idea of producing buildings. So,
perhaps Eduard Kögel,
Perhaps you have can contribute to this question, because what you have shown us is really an entanglement of Chinese and German architecture, or Bauhaus architecture, in the beginning already. So that the modernist architects have already taken elements of the Chinese architects, and so we don't have this topic or this term of influence, but perhaps of transformation and really exchange.
Well, I don't think that there was any exchange. It was just taken for granted. And I don't believe that Gropius understood anything about China. He never had been there. Charon never had been there. But they understood immediately that there is a creative force coming into the given context, which changes their own frame. And they thought it's exciting to see how you can transform landscape into architecture, for instance. Because if you are a part of the environment, you can easily work with your environment. Even if they did not understand the concept, they understood the consequences, which would then transform the space into something completely different. And this was probably the case in both, with both architects. And I think during the whole first part of 20th century, all these colonial cultures influenced modernity quite a lot. Because, I mean, there was people going out to Africa, to Asia, taking photographs, doing research, and trying to understand what they saw. And for instance, my study on Ernst Berschmann was read, was in the library at the Bauhaus. I mean, what Berschmann did in that time. So the people at the Bauhaus, they could study traditional Chinese architecture, and they found some reference, even if they did not go too deep into it, but it was a reference to transform their own conceptions.
And do you think it's necessary to understand the culture you are
somehow? No, I don't think it's necessary, but you have to give up the civilization mission, and you have to accept that there is a multiple identity. You know, I mean, sometimes people are trying to form a singular identity for something, but I believe today we are all living in multiple layers of identity, and therefore we need spaces which are more neutral and allow different identities meeting in one space, in one concept, in order to get along with each other.
Okay, thank you very much. Anna, perhaps you like to contribute something to the question of the hybrid form, which is special in Anna and Lina Bobardi's
case. Well, yes. When she left Italy and arrived in Brazil, she was a modernist architect, a more strict one. But then during time passed, and I think she managed to catch many of the significant importance of Brazilian culture, of many layers of Brazilian culture, that we are a huge country with many influences, and to transform her architecture. She not abandoned at all her conceptions of the early projects, but she managed to take the new the new ideas, the new the culture influence that she found in Brazil, and transform her architecture. Maybe I think maybe hybridization is a good word, but as he said, it's not just a question of form, but also a question of idea, and not just image, but the way people use space, and that's an important thing. And I think that you were also talking about that, so I think
you
this
want
is
to
important.
Add something? Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, everybody's basically talked about these different things, but what I want to add is, yes, there's been this mix and cultural layering, and, you know, because of the way people have moved from one place to the other, but ultimately, we would have to agree, if you're looking at the way things are in the world today, most of the points where we connect tend to be, let me use the word more superficial. Deep down, everybody's still got their strong identities and what they relate to it, the way they use their spaces, which is basically influenced by their environment, their culture. Culture is a lifestyle of people. You have different types of dances in different parts of the world. So if you're going to create a dance studio or a dance center, the way you're going to do it for the African person is going to be different from the person who dances ballet. That's still identity. So you must still refer to the persons and what they do and how they do it, because the building is for the people and not the other way around. It's just, it has to fit. So, I mean, like, you really cannot just displace identity. I don't think so.
What do you think of the idea of unlearning certain things? Because identity is something which also can change, and yes. We are also perhaps mm-hmm. think we have an identity or need an identity because we our bodies have a certain shape, or we learn certain things we can't get rid of, like mm-hmm. Otti Berger once wanted to get rid of herself. Regina Bittner, I think, introduced that sentence this morning to us. So you can also get rid of things that somehow are too narrow mm-hmm. to open up. Yes.
Identity really can change within its own mm-hmm. limits, its own cultural, environment. In fact, our people in Africa have migrated to Europe, to America, and all that, and. If you get to America, the African American is still more African than any other American. They are still basically Africans. And now, what is happening is that if people can change their identity, they are now being expected to change it to a structure, to a design that has been made by somebody. And they are now, like, forced to accept it. Mm-hmm. Yes, they can live within it, but my experience is that they are not comfortable in it. Mm-hmm. Okay. They keep suffering. Okay. And that is, so it is very difficult. Because architecture, culture is geography-based, really. Mm-hmm. There are regions of the world, you know, mm-hmm. and you find people living in that belt mm-hmm. almost live the same way. Mm-hmm. This was conditioned over times, the thousands of years, you know, and even, if our color can differ, but our genetic makeup is really the same. Mm-hmm. We will have to finger our geographical zone over millions of years, and then we find that what we live with is what is we find predominantly in that zone. So it's not easy to make a design. However you can justify it mm-hmm. and think that any other person can move into it, you know, and live comfortably in it. Mm-hmm. The experience is there in Nigeria. Many people build houses, mansions, and they find themselves running away from those buildings.
I think there are questions from the audience. I think we have to open up for the audience.
Okay. Yeah,
Marion von Osten.
Yes, what we find is that they finally find themselves running away from those buildings because the way they are configured is not their way of life. This is real. You know, so for me, I don't think might be a foreigner can, if you live long enough or understand the culture long enough, yes, you can design to suit that culture. That is possible.
I know what you mean.
But not that if you bring a design made for a specific culture in another zone and plant it in another
geographical zone. But that happens a lot, actually.
yeah, it will not work.
Okay,
it doesn't work at all.
Yeah, I think I would like to maybe continue on that thought, because I think that, is, as you say, you can do something that suits maybe a culture or a society or political circumstances, because we also have to say culture changes through also a political condition. It is not stable over thousands of years, it changes. But the interesting thing is that I believe that because of the revolutions it was spoken about, also Ile Ife was built as a protest against the British colonial environment, that this kind of revolutions made and had to make a European to rethink their vocabulary. I think there is, you could even change it and say, you know, there was something, a reciprocal effect of decolonization, where suddenly the modernist had to accept that their universalist idea of a subject was not possible anymore, and that also Gropius had to even somehow adapt to another world perspective after the Second World War, because the geopolitical completely changed, and India became independent, and maybe that's actually why they came, because he didn't really get it. And then they had to also understand that the world changed, and then they had to also change their practice. And I think that would be an interesting way that we all had to change after this short century of the last 100 years. We all had to become others. We couldn't. We were not able to stay where we were.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure.
It's a comment.
Eduard?
Well, I think we have to accept that learning never ends. And we have to teach the students that they are not finished if they leave university. I mean, then it starts, learning, the real thing. And we should give up the idea to learn from best practice. We should start to learn from failure, because I think we can learn much more if we understand why something fails. And I think, therefore, the whole curriculum should be changed. That's my point.
I think that sometimes it's good to engage architecture with theories and philosophies that would help us to unravel those. Lefebvre talks about the fact that space is socially produced. There's no neutral space. You can't. And one thing I have toiled with is to look at the way that people have appropriated space. No matter what you give people, they will find a way out of it. But this process of appropriation can be either oppressive, or to the other extreme, can be made a lot easier. I've had a situation on the campus where we've had to deal with a lot of people with fancy PhDs from strange countries in the world and everywhere, US and all that. And then you get to the kitchen and it's so problematic about whether the platform, the table that you use is essentially the place to cook or is the floor. And you see marks of it on the floor. And these are people, some lived in the US for 25 years, and yet they still put the food on the floor, and you know, you have to make it. It's just, they appropriate the space in ways that suit them. That's why sometimes we don't even know that there are conflicts in any way. But it's a process of, we must know that space is always socially produced. It's not neutral.
Yeah, very good. Are there any more? Yeah, you'll get an applause. Are there any more questions from the audience? They're in the back. Yeah. No, there's a microphone.
Thank you very much. I actually have two questions. One is just a question of maybe understanding or a little more explanation to Mrs. Birnbach. You mentioned that there was a difference being made, that Dina Bobadi had the intention to narrow the gap between the creation, execution, and use of objects, And I actually was wondering whether you could elaborate a little more about what execution actually means, because to me it's not really clear what the execution of objects is. And then I have another question to Mr. Nwoko, because I was very interested in learning why you actually choose for the new cultural studios the form of the amphitheater, because it's something that you mentioned, you cannot really bring something somewhere else and expect that it would work, but then you actually did that. And I was wondering what the qualities of the amphitheater are that you thought would actually enable this new learning culture. Thanks.
Well, at that time when Lina Bobardi was in Bahia, as I mentioned, she managed to go through the territory of the Northeast, and she and some other people, they were trying to find the places where the objects were produced. So and she was very interested on that production, and the way that people used materials, the techniques they used, the execution, I mean the execution by this kind of thing, the way the materials were used, how the techniques were applied to arrive in a certain object. So what she meant, as at the other school, for instance, and I think in many aspects, there is that point that someone creates and some other people execute. And what she meant was to bring together the creation and execution all in the same place. And for those people that only created objects, that they could join the producers and to learn from them, and also in the other way, that they also the producers could not improve, but to also deal in a more clear way with the process of creation. So I think that's the point, you know, to narrow the gap between these things. And finally, what she meant and what she didn't finally achieved was to make this school and the school that would join all these people and to finally bring these objects to an industrial scale. So that was what she was thinking. And I think that's a question. We were talking about that yesterday. No, the thing that we still in a gap, I don't know if it's still, but
I think yes.
Yes. Okay. No, in a thing about the people who create, they're in one position and the other ones who just execute. In industrial production is still somehow like that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I answered, but it's more or less this way.
Dimas Moko.
Yes.
The role of the amphitheater in your work.
Yes.
Yes. Why did you use the form of the amphitheater in the cultural center? Because it is an adopted form. That was
in our culture in Africa, we had not built any physical theater before, but we have theater, we have drama, we have dance, and these are executed, you know, in public locations, and then they in these platforms they are done in a type of formation, which is usually virtually in the round. Meaning that the performers are in the middle, they leave the one end where they can come from and retire. So, I went to France to study European theater building. Mm-hmm. And after I studied those buildings in Europe, they were mostly proscenium. We had known in picture a Shakespearean stage, which was much more like the Colosseum, evolving from the Roman. So we are now going to go and build a theater. So I looked at all the forms of already built theaters in Europe. Mm-hmm. And I saw that the Greek amphitheater fitted the bill, really. And also, the one element, which is highly technological, the proscenium theater in Europe seemed to have acoustic problem. Mm-hmm. Very bad one, and they've been trying all type of ways to solve it. But the Greek amphitheater had a very acoustic effect without any amplification. I went there and I checked that out. So I decided to adopt this style. Though it was going to be covered with the roof, I didn't know how it would come out, you know, after it had been covered, until I finished the theater building, and like the one I built in my own studio, it seemed to have worked out very well. So yes, you could. Architecture, you could borrow from anywhere, but it has to fit into what you are doing with it. You don't just borrow for borrowing's sake. That's what is happening now. Mm-hmm. But if you have some good money, you will choose a typical American ranch from California and build it in Lagos. It doesn't work.
Yeah, you're right.
Everybody that have done that, up to 100 million naira, you know, they don't live in it.
If this is what
they
you mean,
run away from it.
I'm not sure if that really is in hybrid form, but anyhow.
You know, so really, yeah. That is the point. You are free to borrow. Yeah. Every culture is free to borrow.
I think that's the point.
But you have to swallow it and digest it. Make it part of your, resolve it with your way of life, because you want comfort.
Yeah.
Culture is designed for your comfort, expressly for your comfort. So you must go through that process of making it accessible to your culture, your way of life. It doesn't work any other way.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, our time is up already. That was really fast. I think we could have spent much more time to discuss all your interesting topics. And I only want to mention we have now a half an hour break, coffee break. There's coffee in the Hirschfeld Bar, and I think cake as well. And then I want to announce that in the next panel, Sandra Benitez will give her talk in Portuguese. So if you need headphones, you get one at the entrance. Thank you very much.